Holly came from Miami, FLA. Hitchhiked away across USA. Plucked her eyebrows on the way, shaved her legs, and then he was a she. She says, "Hey, babe."
Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer and biographer Howard Soons. We're talking about his latest book, The Life of Lou Reed, Notes from the Velvet Underground. Howard, welcome to the show. This seems like it was a difficult biography to do, was it?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, yeah, there was a sort of rub between my initial admiration for Lou Reed as a listener and the reality of the man I discovered.
Well, and for people who aren't familiar, I mean, I'm sure everybody's familiar with the Velvet Underground and Lou Reed, but if they're not familiar with the person, I think difficult is what one of the terms that I would come up with. There's probably a lot more, but he's a tough person to warm up to.
Yeah, he was a difficult person, and a lot of artists are, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't blame them for that, really. Life is difficult and a struggle, but he was difficult to the point of being unpleasant to a lot of people. So I did tend to get this same story from lots of interviewees saying how horrible he'd been, and unreasonable and obnoxious and rude and just a really unpleasant person to deal with. And inevitably that influenced the narrative, because there was so much of that evidence. I wasn't looking for it. That's just what people said.
Well, what's amazing is in the last part of his life, when he was with Laurie Anderson, you have to wonder what she found attractive, but she really was a positive influence on him.
Yeah, and I love her. I love her work, and she's such a charming and bright, brilliant person, really. I mean, in many ways, I think he was batting. He was punching above his weight with her. He did very well to marry Laurie Anderson. But who knows? The marriages are unknowable, aren't they?
That's right. That's right.
Maybe he was a project for her, and maybe he was different with her. I don't know. I presume that she was a match for him in terms of success, strength of character, etc. And maybe he didn't feel he could push her around like everyone else.
She really loved him, and that's what's clear in your book. She really, really did love him.
Yeah, now, absolutely, yeah.
Let's talk about his childhood, because people who know him as the man who penned Walk on the Wild Side, he was born in Brooklyn, then he moved to Long Island. He had a pretty conventional childhood.
Oh, yes. I mean, the idea of Lou Reed being the poet of the streets and even being the poet of Manhattan is a kind of confection, really. He's a suburban, white, middle-class Jewish boy who gravitated to the city and fell in love with the darker side of life and the poetry of the gutter. But he was like so many artists, like Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen of that generation. He was a middle-class kid. And he grew up in a pretty conventional, if not privileged, family.
But, and as is obvious from your book, from a teenage years, he was a provocateur. I mean, he made the acid comments right when he was a teenager, to the point where he ended up being treated for, including electroconvulsive therapy, as a teenager.
Yeah, so that's really the great event in his childhood, or the traumatic event in his early life, where he has this mental breakdown essentially at college, and he has ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, and he blames his father for this throughout his career in innumerable interviews, and he kind of conflates it with his sexuality, and he suggests his dad didn't accept the fact that he was gay or bisexual, and that this ECT was somehow about that. But in fact, nobody whom one interviews, including his sister, who's really the authority on this because she's the last living witness, nobody believes that. In fact, I think Lou was a difficult, unhappy, mixed-up kid. And it was the era when ECT was more commonly prescribed for depression and mental illness. And his parents were probably just trying to do the best they could with a very difficult, unhappy boy.
I love the fact, I like the names of some of his early bands, like the Tree Toads, the Shades, the CHDs. And that you detail those in the books. When did he first meet John Cale? I'm going to have to skip around a lot because there's so much in this book. I'm going to sort of focus on personalities that interacted with Lou. When did he first meet John Cale?
Well, he after college, he goes to work for this strange company called Pickwick Records on Long Island, just the other end of Long Island. And he, writing kind of pastiches of the hits of the day for cheap supermarket, sort of pastiches of the Beatles, surf songs, pastiches of whatever was trendy, for very little money, just like a song factory. And in doing so, he meets John Cale, because John Cale's brought in to play on one of these songs, this famous song he wrote called The Ostrich, which is just like a nonsense song. And John Cale was of course, an avant-garde musician from the United Kingdom, and he had a classical education, and he was a protege of Aaron Copland. I mean, he was in the States on this scholarship, really, at a very high level. And suddenly he's playing with Lou Reed in this kind of crackers made up band, this mad song, which has become a sort of collector's item. And that's the start of their friendship.
There's the band was the Falling Spikes, then they become the Warlocks, and eventually they become Velvet Underground. Where did the name come from?
So the name The Underground comes from just a trashy novel, or not actually a novel. I mean, I think it's a long time since I read it, but it was a sort of trashy book about sort of a sociological study of sexual mores, called The Velvet Underground, and they took the band name from that. And it's just got a ring about it, because I guess the Velvet Underground's music, or their lyrics really, was about a sort of loose side of underground life, you know, sex, drugs, but kind of getting high, having a good time maybe, but, you know, away from the mainstream. So it seems to conjure that up.
Now, who were the original four Velvets? There's Lou, there's John, who else?
Sterling Morrison was a friend of Lou's, who played the other bass guitar, he played rhythm guitar. And then, wonderfully, they had this wonderful female drummer called Mo Tucker, who, one of the nicest people you ever meet, by the way, and one of the very few people who Lou never fell out with, because I guess she was no competition. She's a very easygoing person, to this day lives a very low-key life down in Georgia. And she's one of the very few people I found writing the book who was in touch with him until the end, and they'd stayed friends.
You know, wow.
Until the end. Yeah, I mean, almost everyone else he pissed off, alienated, you know, but Mo was kind of forgiving, but also she would tell him off when he was behaving badly, and he would take it from her. And I think her sound, I mean, if anyone knows about Underground, you know, they have this very sort of simple rhythmic sound. And that's because Mo was a very basic, a very straightforward drummer, almost like a child bashing on a tin, really. But it somehow works.
I became more and more fascinated with Maureen the more I read your book, because she is this sort of constant voice in and out of the entire story.
Yes, and she's such an ordinary, normal person. You know, she's not a druggy person. She's a very conventional, straightforward, almost conservative character, actually. And quite, you know, quite an unexpected character in that mix.
Now, how did they hook?
She was very shocked by all the, you know.
I know. I'm amazed she lasted as long as she did. How did they hook up with Andy Warhol eventually, and the whole factory crowd?
They're just playing a gig in Greenwich Village in a coffee house for peanuts, or for hamburgers, literally. And Gerard Malanga, you know, Andy's acolyte, he sees them there, and he takes Andy and Paul Morrissey down from the factory one day just to see this band, because it looks weird. Lou's this kind of good-looking young guy. John Cale's playing a viola. Mo is a woman, of course. So they're a very unusual-looking act. And, of course, they have novelty appeal, and that appeals to Warhol.
The whole story, I mean, people have to read your book, the whole story of them becoming essentially the house band for the factory and Andy Warhol is amazing, but he really rubbed Paul Morrissey the wrong way, and Paul rubbed him the wrong way. They had a really fractious relationship.
Absolutely. I mean, if people don't know who Paul Morrissey is, he was kind of Andy Warhol's right-hand man, and he became a filmmaker. And he knew, he's a very kind of bitter character. He resents the fact that everyone talks about Warhol and doesn't talk about his contribution to the factory. And I rang him up. One of the best quotes I've ever had for any book, I've written 10 books, was when I rang Paul Morrissey up in Manhattan when I was writing this book on a snowy winter's day. And he's a very camp kind of guy. And he said to me, "Do you think anyone wants to read about the life of Lou Reed?" And I said, "You know what, I think so. Paul is quite a significant character." And he said to me, "What are you going to call it?" And I said, "Oh, something pretentious like Notes from the Velvet Underground." And he said, "Oh, no, you need a good title like The Hateful Bitch or The Worst Person Who Ever Lived." Something that says this isn't a biography of a great human being. This is Paul saying this to me, because he was not. He was a stupid, disgusting, awful human being. Now, there's some humor in that, because this is the way Paul Morrison talks.
Right,
and
it, right.
You have to take it with a pinch of salt. But it also came from a place of obvious, deep, visceral loathing. He obviously hated Lou Reed. He'd grown to hate him over the years. And he was wonderfully blunt about that, which I thought was refreshing and funny, actually.
He was the one that forced them to take on Nico as the vocalist.
Yeah, Nico, the beautiful German chanteuse, if that's the right pronunciation, who couldn't really sing but looked good and became this kind of much-to-lose resentment, became the front person of this act.
Now, how did Lou feel about her personally and then professionally? Because initially, sure, I mean, he hated the fact that she was there initially.
Yeah, intensely jealous, then had sex with her, although he was... I mean, his sexuality in itself is a whole story.
Oh, yeah, and that comes out throughout the book.
He's obviously actively bisexual throughout most of his life, and so he's quite capable of sleeping with men and women, and sleeps with Nico, and that kind of seems to settle things down for a bit, but then he basically hates her, and he's quite happy to get rid of her as soon as possible because she attracts all the limelight, although she only, in fact, ever sang kind of two or three songs.
Right.
She had two or three songs which she would perform, Sunday Morning, I guess, or whatever her songs were, and or Tomorrow's Parties. And Lou would sing the rest of the songs.
Now, 1966 was the big year for the Velvet Underground and for Andy Warhol. Why is it the big year?
You have to remind me, 66, did you say?
I think that's when the Banana album comes out.
Yeah, so, I mean, yes, their first great album, Andy Warhol introduces the Velvet Underground, the first album with the Yellow Banana pop art cover. I mean, it's one of those albums that's, to people like who love them, for me, it's one of the greatest rock and roll albums ever made.
Right, absolutely.
It's an album that David Bowie and Blondie and all those people, Talking Heads and Patti Smith, all rave about and were influenced by. But it also sold in tiny, tiny, tiny numbers.
Oh, yeah.
It was never a hit, but it had this disproportionate influence on people who happened to hear it because it was so original and powerful. And despite the novelty look of the Velvet Underground, it was really, and it is really great art. I mean, it's a brilliant, brilliant record.
Now, there's a West Coast tour of the Velvets with the Exploding Plastic Inevitable, Andy's whole shtick there. And it's sort of funny to read about the Velvet Underground going west to the land of hippies at that time. Because if there ever was not a peace and love band, it was the Velvet Underground. How did they fare going to the West Coast?
Well, badly, you know, but I think they played up that. They played up to that thing. We're the serious intellectual people from New York. And they went to the beach and they just sat there in their polo necks with their dark glasses, didn't even take their shirts off, you know, sat there sort of taking heroin on the beach. And they were deliberately gloomy like the Munsters. It was a bit of an act, really, a bit of shtick. But, I mean, what the reality was that nobody liked them. You know, they played at this club on the Strip. And I think Cher went with Sonny Bono, and she just walked out. She turned around and walked straight out. And they got terrible reviews, and they didn't sell any records. And they were it was the summer of the Mamas and the Papas, California Dreaming, and all the rest of it. And they were completely—they were in the wrong place. They were just—they went to play at Bill Graham's place in San Francisco, and he told them to get off. You know, they were—they were just not—they were not in tune with the times.
Now, you're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer and biographer Howard Soons, and we're talking about his latest book. It's a great read, The Life of Lou Reed, Notes from the Velvet Underground. Now, there's sort of a falling out eventually. Andy becomes more interested in films, like after he makes Chelsea Girls, and less interested in the Velvets, and the Velvets eventually fall apart. What caused them to fall apart?
Well, a lack of success, really. I mean, one of the most striking things I thought researching the book was the weekend of the Woodstock Festival, when 500,000 people, whatever it was, were out there in upstate New York, you know, grooving to Santana and all those great bands. I mean, where were the Velvet Underground? The Velvet Underground were as important as any band at Woodstock in terms of their influence and their artistic achievement, but they were totally unknown. They were playing a club, a roadhouse in Massachusetts that weekend to like 50 people, and they made no money, and they didn't sell any records, and no one went to the shows. It was they were a complete flop in those terms, and I think ultimately Lou just broke his heart, really.
It's interesting, and he also develops a sort of an antagonistic relationship with John Cale, but like a lot of these people that he develops these antagonistic relations to, they sort of drift back together decades later and then drift apart again. What's amazing when we talk about, you know, you talked about the first album and how badly it sold, but as you mentioned in your book, it's amazing how many people who later became important rock and rollers or groundbreaking rock and rollers cite that album as a major influence.
Yeah, I mean, the most famous example is David Bowie, who hears it in England, growing up unknown himself. When he gets his record deal, he goes to New York to sign with RCA. Young David Bowie, not yet a superstar, but certainly, you know, on the way up. And the first thing he wants to do is meet Lou Reed. And Lou Reed, by this time, is all washed up. His Velvet Underground he's left the Underground. He's had another nervous breakdown. He's working for his dad, who's an accountant, as a typist out on Long Island, and he's nowhere. You know, he's just nowhere in his career. But David Bowie invites him, and they go to lunch, and then Bowie kind of mentors him and gets his solo career going.
Well, he produces Transformer, which is really the album that makes Lou Reed's independent career, solo career.
Yeah. So this fantastic second album, which is, strangely enough, was produced in London, recorded in London. It sounds like the quintessential New York album, but it was made in London with David Bowie and Bowie's guys and engineers, and at Trident Studios, where the Beatles made recorded Hey Jude, etc., in Soho, here in London. And it was a big hit, and he had this novelty single, of course, Walk on the Wild Side, was a top 10 hit on both sides of the Atlantic.
And it was all about people he knew.
Yeah, people from the factory, the trans characters, the people who are now, most of whom are now dead, but yeah, people like Joe D'Alessandro and Candy Darling and Holly Woodlawn.
Well, I want to spend a moment talking about David Bowie and Lou, because there's a totally weird part in your book where they literally come to blows, and it's bizarre. I mean, Lou sort of slaps Bowie a bunch of times, then they sort of make up immediately in a restaurant, and then they slap each other. And Bowie ends up like challenging him to fight outside. I can't even believe Bowie did that. But talk about that incident. That was like weird.
Yeah, it's a great story, like a great scene in a film, actually.
Yeah, it would be. It was absolutely cinematic.
And it's the great thing about it is there's loads of witnesses, because basically Lou gave a show in London in the mid-70s, when he's basically on the skids again, drinking heavily, not selling many records. Bowie comes, sits backstage, watches the show. Bowie's now a superstar. Afterwards, they go out for dinner, and all Lou's band is there, like 10 people, and all his girlfriend, everyone's there, and they all witness what happens. Lou's drunk. He asks David to come and produce his next LP to sort of, you know, let's get the winning team together again, Bowie says something rather condescending like, "Okay, Lou, if you clean yourself up, maybe we can do it." Lou takes exception, hits him in the restaurant. Everyone freaks out, says, "Oh, Lou, sit down, don't hit David Bowie." Lou sits down, goes back to eating his dinner, and then 2 minutes later he gets up again and hits him again. It's like a kind of Charlie Chaplin slapstick thing. So then they bundle him out of the restaurant, take him back to his hotel. This is Lou. Goes into his hotel suite with his band and his girlfriend, sitting around listening to the tape of the that night's show. And there's a knock on the door, and who is it? It's David Bowie, come, furious, to have a fight. He's saying, come out and fight like a man.
First of all, that sounds so un-David-like at that, yeah. that point, but I just can imagine what that would be. But Lou doesn't even open the door.
Well, Lou, according to his band, who I interviewed, Lou pretends to be asleep at this stage. Because Lou is, as they say in England, all mouth and no trousers. I mean, he's the persona of a tough guy, but of course he isn't a tough guy. And so when dear old David Bowie, as effete as David Bowie was, sort of knocks on the door and says, "Come out and fight like a man," Lou pretends to be asleep, and that's how the story ends. It's a hilarious story, but there are about 10 witnesses to it, so it's beyond dispute.
Now they don't really make up after that.
No, they don't. Well, I mean, Lou did perform at Bowie's 50th birthday gig at Madison Square Garden, which was quite a bit later than that. So, but you get the impression there's a lot of jealousy. Lou's really jealous of Bowie's success because Lou never really gets into the big time. He never sells records in anything like the volume of people like David Bowie. And so he's always a little bit niggly about that.
Two albums I want to talk about before we run out of time. One that has always bothered me ever since it came out, and I can remember this well, and have not gone back and revisited it, Metal Machine Music. Talk to me about what was that about?
Well, it's really about drugs. I mean, one of the things about Lou Reed, actually, is that the reality is that a lot of his career, he was either drunk or he was stoned. And he went for a long phase of being a speed addict, really, just taking amphetamines all the time. And this obviously messed up his artistic judgment. He's also just a very difficult person. And I think a mixture of drugs and spite against RCA, he decides to give them an album of basically feedback, four sides of feedback. No lyrics, no melody, no songs, just like white noise, which he did in his apartment with a guitar and an amp, just gave the tapes to RCA and insisted that they put it out. And they put it out as this thing called Metal Machine Music, which is basically just a joke. But it did come out, you know, and in fact, to this day, you can buy it. You can buy a CD of it. I mean, I challenge anybody to listen to it from start to finish. That would be a really bizarre thing to do because it's four sides of white noise.
And I want to talk about Songs for Drilla. I think one of the most interesting projects he was involved in the later part of his career. His relationship, with Andy was troubled after they left, but he does this album with John Cale, which is essentially a tribute to Andy Warhol.
Yeah, and I think the best thing he did, really, after leaving the band, the Velvet Underground band, the second best thing of his career after those first three albums in the 60s was this thing called Songs for Drella. Because it's just got all the originality and sense of place, and the lyrics are really well written, the music's beautiful, and it's got a sincerity to it, and which is really lacking from lots of his solo career.
Now, we have to pay attention to the Laurie Anderson years, when they got together, it's almost as if he changed. Now, he'd been plagued by illnesses for a lot of part of his life, probably as a consequence of his drug use. He always had liver problems. But she really comes along and, you know, all sorts of strange things start to happen to him. He starts to communicate with people better. He shows an interest in nature. He shows an interest in in sort of Buddhism. Talk about that. I mean, it's really an amazing transformation that happens to Lou.
Well, yeah, and I think some of his best records actually are at the end of his life when he's with her. I mean, The Raven is really good.
Yeah, yeah.
Set the Twilight Reeling. I mean, these are really good albums. Unfortunately, no one's heard them because they just, by this time, he's just not selling records in any quantity. So he's really making good music. But he's still pretty awkward, you know. I mean, the last thing he famously does is this thing with Metallica called Lulu.
Right.
Which is, you know, really god-awful rubbish. And it's mad, unpleasant, horrible stuff. And if you talk to the people who were working with him at the end of his life, I mean, he was still very, very difficult. His manager, his personal assistant. I mean, there's hilarious stories in the book about the crazy way he would behave to the people who worked for him. You know, completely just unreasonable, difficult, obnoxious, incredibly demanding, never happy, never satisfied, never grateful, never said thank you. But he made some good records at the end of his life. I mean, I think some of the best, much, much better than those more famous 70s albums like Sally Can't Dance and Berlin, which I think are grossly overrated. Although when he reprised the Berlin album as a live show at the end of his career,
right,
it worked much better, I thought, on stage than it did as an LP.
We're out of time. We could be talking about Lou Reed for years. There's an awful lot in this book, and we've just been skipping around. My guest tonight has been writer and biographer Howard Soons, and we're talking about his dynamite new biography, The Life of Lou Reed, Notes from the Velvet Underground. Howard, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.
Holly came from Miami, FLA. Hitchhiked away across USA. Plucked her eyebrows on the way. Shaved her legs and then he was a she. She says, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey, honey, take a walk on the wild side.